Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitted across the internet. This is episode 247 of Registry Matters. How are you this evening, you people?
We're very well. Nice and cool, but very well.
Fantastic. Before we get going, make sure you press the like and subscribe and get the notification bell, then add a thumbs up to this video, and that will add all the sugar, spice, and everything nice to the YouTube algorithm, and maybe some more people will find this content. And we would appreciate it very much. Do you want to banter about anything, or do you want to dive right in, Larry?
Well, we can banter a little bit. We're going to do a brief discussion about the upcoming, what would have been a national rail strike.
And that sounds fun.
So, it sounds fun?
Yes, it sounds fun. Well, so before we get going, though, I do have a question that I need to ask you, though. Is so since we just crossed our five-year mark, right? And with your age and retirement, and I've now named you as actually Dr. Doom and Gloom.
How much longer are you planning to stay?
A long time. Get used to me.
What does the rail strike have to do with our issue exactly?
Well, it doesn't directly in terms of our issue, but it has to do with political analysis. So we're going to get a little bit into the analysis of what happened in the legislation that the president just signed and a little bit of the hypocrisy and the inconsistent contortions that went place. So, but I was afraid you were going to ask me that, but we're going to get into the political analysis. And also, we had a fantastic jobs report, which I want to spend a few minutes on. And then we got some listener questions tonight. And then we're going to do a segment on Interstate Compact, dealing with probable cause hearings. And we have some articles. And so it's going to be a great program. It's going to last for hours and hours.
Probably. Since you mentioned jobs report, I do want to like send a shout out to one of our patrons and a good friend of mine, and he has had a pretty high dollar job for a number of years, and someone like doxed him. They went onto the company website and they posted and contacted every person, like the director, finance. They found all the different people and they posted and they said, hey, this guy's on the registry in another state. And 2 weeks go by, they fired him.
That's really sad.
It's really like, I mean, that's a complete SH move. And We talk pretty regularly about, is there any way to file anything legally? And it's like, first, you'd have to find the person that did it. How would you prove that they did it with like malicious intent beyond just informing them? Maybe they didn't know at his job and he was just informing. Like, that's a really murky road to try and travel to try and do anything with this issue.
Well, it gets into some interesting legal areas because don't know what states we're talking about, but many, if not the majority of our states are employment at will, meaning that a person can be employed or unemployed. Their employment can be terminated for no reason because the employer maintains that right in an employment at will state. Unless, of course, you do one of the prohibited actions related to discrimination, which is largely things that a person can't help, their nation they're born in, and disabilities and certain things that are prohibited. Be interesting to know if he lives in a state that has an enhanced level of protection where he might have a cause of action. And then it would be interesting to know that if he disclosed the fact that he was on the registry, or if they even ask in the beginning, because if they're firing him now, and they didn't ask in the beginning, that seems a little bit, not a little bit, that seems quite wrong.
I believe they knew. But because it became like super public from people that may not have known, like, I mean, I believe his boss knew and maybe somebody else, but the quote unquote, the board didn't know. Once the board found it, they were like, they felt that they had liability and so forth like that, that he was there.
That's
he is not on the registry in the state he lives in.
That's typically what happens. Those lowest levels of supervision, they're aware of it and they're okay with it. But then when all hell breaks loose because of the public nature of the registry, when the public pressure starts being applied, then it all changes and the SHIT rolls downhill and the right. person who made the hiring and the exception gets questioned, why did you make the exception for this? And that's why no one wants to make any exceptions. But I think that he, depending on the state, might want to seek redress because there may be some options. And certainly this would help prove the registry itself is the reason for his termination because it was the doxing and the revelation that he was on the registry.
Yep. Totally. All right. Well, enough of that. Can you please feel free to go through and do your jobs report now, please, sir?
All right. So yesterday, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that the American economy added 263,000 jobs in the month of November, and the unemployment rate remained close to historic low at 3.7%. This report brings good news for working families as the economy continues its transition into steady, stable growth. Since the start of this administration, the economy has added 10.5 million jobs, and there are now more than 1 million more Americans working than there were before the pandemic. Now, hear that one more time. We have restored all the jobs. We're 1 million above what was the all-time record in the previous administration. And there are yet 10 million unfilled jobs that are going begging due to the chronic labor worker shortage. And many of these jobs are very high-paying, skilled ones, such as airline pilots, doctors, and engineers. So again, America, when are you going to do something about your labor shortage? We've got 10 million people who can be paying taxes, 10 million jobs that would be generating taxes and economic activity, but we're just going to let them remain unfilled until when? But yep, great jobs report.
Yeah, and as I continue to say, this number probably has to change, though, the number that I have in my head. It's 150,000 jobs per month to maintain no improvement or decrement in the unemployment rate. So 263 is a good chunk over that. I don't know if that 150 has changed any. I've never heard it an update to it.
Well, it's an elastic number because people exit the labor force, and then when the economy gets stronger, traditionally people have reentered the labor market in search of, you know, they hear that there's openings, they hear that salaries and wages are going up, and people reenter the workforce because it's a magnet effect that brings people back in. It seems like now that even with this chronic shortage, we've had a similar number since the end of the Obama presidency in 2016. We had like 8 million unfilled jobs. We hit over 11 million, and we're still over 10 million unfilled jobs. So the strength of this economy, the draw is just not there. With all these high-paying jobs that are open and they can't fill them, at some point we need to recognize the workers just aren't there.
Yeah, when you have a six-figure job and someone's not filling it, of course there's always people that are like, I'm not doing that job because I don't want to. But I think more so than not is we don't have the population to fill the job.
That is correct. And we have people who get to choose not to work. And I'm going really off script now, but I have a friend whose niece is the highest level of nurse. I can't keep those, but the highest amount where you, if you were working, you could be making the highest amount of money.
Yeah.
She has that education. She's in her 30s and she's raising a family and she's choosing not to work. Her husband is a CFO of a hospital. And he makes good money. And this friend, bless his heart, he's always talking about there's so many sorry people that won't work. So I confronted him. I said, well, your niece is a highly trained individual. She could be providing a great service to the community right now. She could be in nursing. She could be pulling down six figures. Is she one of those sorry people that won't work? There are people who choose not to work because their economic circumstances allow them not to work. And that's the beauty of a free right. country. You don't have to work if you don't want to work and if you can support yourself. She is choosing to raise her children. She's choosing to be at home. There's nothing wrong with that choice, but for the greater good, she could be in nursing right now, pulling down six figures. But that's her choice. We have a lot of people in the economy that their prosperity in the previous couple of decades, they accumulated enough money in their 401ks. They took early retirement. They don't want to work anymore. They're 54 years old. They've got the resources not to work. You get to make that choice in America. I don't know why that discombobulates people so much. You have the right not to work.
Does this tie into you in any way in the rail strike thing that the bipartisan stuff happened in Congress this past week?
It does tie in indirectly. The worker shortage is a real issue. And the rail strike that was averted through congressional action would have been a devastating blow to the economy because we already don't have enough truckers. You know, that's a profession that pays reasonably well, and there's not enough people. That's why those driverless trucks are going to be in our future, because we don't have enough humans that want to do that work anymore. But since there's a shortage of already of truckers, the elasticity is not there to take on the shipping. So the Congress quickly invoked, I think it's something from 1926 that has to do with their authority to regulate the rail industry. And they invoked a settlement at the instigation of a Democratic president. Now, we're going to get to bash both the Democrats and the Republicans tonight because they both parties got themselves in a contorted position. But the lesson for our listeners is that what drove this was the political necessity. The political necessity is that the economy would take a devastating hit. We don't know how much of a hit, but it would be devastating to have the rails shut down, the railroad companies to quit moving freight. So the Republicans, who normally claim that they believe in letting the market resolve its issues, which by that doctrine, if they really believed it, they would have allowed a strike to happen. They would have allowed the companies to try to hire what's called scab workers, replacement workers, or bid up their wages to try to get people to fill the jobs if they truly believed that the market would take care of it. So they would have stood down and let the workers go on strike. The Democrat Party that claims it's the friend of workers, it would have stood down and let the negotiating process work. And the most powerful and the, really the only tool that organized labor has is the power of a work slowdown or a stoppage. They would have allowed the stoppage to go forward. So the Democrats did a flip-flop, and they used the power of government to impose a settlement. And the party of no government intervention, they did the same thing for slightly different reasons, but they did the same thing. And they protected the interest of the railroad companies to keep them operating. And if they truly believed that competition would fix this, they would let the rail companies deal with the shortage of workers and hiring new workers. But truly, they don't. They looked at the political things, and they know that there's not enough workers out there. They know that it would be devastating, and they decided to jettison everything else and use the power of government to put the rail situation to rest. Now, it's going to be interesting to see if they actually work at full capacity, if the workers actually don't call in sick anyway, to see if there's any sabotage, which has been known to happen with organized labor. Things break down mysteriously. It's going to be interesting to see if they work at full productive capacity. Time will tell. But the political lesson is that the considerations won the day, and the Democratic Party abandoned its interest in protecting organized labor. And one more thing, if we had a Republican president right now, and a Republican president had done this, the Democratic Party would be crying foul. They would be saying that they neutered the tool of organized labor.
Sure. So, just in my mind, the vastness of our rail network and the reliance on it, it feels vaguely similar to us subsidizing our farming so that you have a very stable milk prices and bread prices, and those staples do not radically change because we subsidize farmers, even to the point that if they have a completely failed crop, we pay them anyway so that they will stay in business and we don't have this radical flux of farming up and down. This feels similar. The farmers are corporate, private owned, and this is the same that the rail's all private company owned kind of things. Shouldn't we do something to, I don't want to say nationalize it, but shore it up so that this type of thing isn't in play?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I agree with what you're saying, but I'm trying to illuminate that people who claim that they believe in pure capitalism, they really don't. People who claim, you can't do what the Republicans just went along with and claim that you're market oriented, because the markets were not allowed to work to see if this could be resolved. And the Democratic Party clearly wasn't the party of labor, because they capitulated and they didn't get their sick leave. They were looking, I think it was like 7 days a year they were trying to get, and they ended up getting one day. I'm not sure I've had the facts right, but the
I heard something weird about something with like, oh, 3 days vacation. Like, that's the issue. And I'm sure it's totally not. That was some oversimplification and mischaracterization of it all.
So, but there are times when I think that bringing the power of government, like with the Defense Production Act, you know, that was contemplated when Trump was president, you know, trying to produce, what was it, the ventilators and yes, certain things. There was discussion about the Defense Production Act. There are times when it is in the national interest, but then you have to come off your intellectual high horse where you say that capitalism can solve all problems. You have to admit that the power of government is necessary to do some things. You can't have it both ways.
Boy, we could diverge onto like 10 different directions from that, but I think we should shelve it there and stop doing the Larry Matters on Labor podcast or whatever the hell we would call that.
All right.
Well, then let's move over to a question that came in from Mike. It says, "Hello, Larry and Andy. I enjoyed the segment on the Interstate Compact as I've been through that process. There's one area that I believe Larry didn't mention. Larry, I thought you mentioned every area." He says, when it comes to the controlling state, in the case of probation, the conditions set by the court are only the conditions they can revoke you on. Case in point, the receiving state adds some random condition that's not on your original sentencing court conditions, but you violate that new condition. During the retaking and appearance before the sentencing court, you argue that condition X, this new condition, wasn't in the original court agreement. I have read the ICOTS Duhigg bench book that in such a situation, a probationer can only be in violation of those original conditions. So, Larry, I give you the floor and please elaborate.
Well, he's put an organized, coherent thought together. And the truth is, we don't know the answer to this. The bench book suggests strongly that conditions imposed in the receiving state are to be treated by the sending state as if they had been imposed there. But in reality, you got the human factor, and you've got judges who are sitting in the state that says that sent a person, allowed them to be transferred, and they say, well, I didn't tell them that in my conditions of probation, and if they'd have stayed here, we wouldn't revoke them for that. So therefore, you may have a judge who says, yeah, just because New Mexico wanted them to do that, we wouldn't have required that here. So that is a distinct possibility that you may end up in a situation where they wouldn't revoke you. I think the question he's asking, can they revoke you, or are they forbidden? I think they can revoke you. I do not believe, my personal opinion is, I do not believe they're forbidden to revoke you. I say that because you sign, when you request transfer, you sign a stipulation saying that you agree to abide by the conditions that are imposed in the receiving state. You sign that knowing that if you refuse it, you're likely not going to be allowed to transfer. But that, to me, is the same thing as if you go to the probation office after the judge has sentenced you, and the probation office gives you additional conditions that are routine in nature, or maybe a condition that the probation officer discovers that he or she thinks is appropriate for you. They hand that to you and say, sign this. This is a new condition of probation. Can the judge revoke you for not following that? I believe the judge can. And I know that, in fact, the judges do revoke you for things that they didn't put in the original conditions. They typically, the probation officer has you sign those, and then they get sent back to the court to be signed by the judge. And they are typically added by the court at the behest of the probation office. But in terms of this, it's kind of murky. I would be very leery of going back to a state where I had been originally sentenced and saying, judge, you cannot revoke me because you didn't impose this on me. I would be very leery of hanging my hat on that argument. But it's not without any rationality to it. I mean, he is making sense. It's just, we don't know the answer to this. We'd have to wait and see, and it would have to go up on appeal. But my feeling is that if you agree to the conditions and you don't adhere to them, I believe your supervision could be revoked in the sending state.
Would you step out on a limb and suggest, can we hypothetically say this condition? I'm the only one that's coming to, like, so one of my probation conditions was, I always love this one, you shall never drive alone, especially in places where children are known to congregate. Like, so let's just say the state that you've started in doesn't have that, and then you go to Georgia where they do have that, and you say, this wasn't part of my original conditions? Is that the scenario?
Well, you're making a point, and I would argue that slightly differently. I would argue that is an impossible condition.
Oh, I know it is. I know, but it's there. It's written, and I signed it, and I'm like, when you say come to my office, are you going to come pick me up so I don't have to drive alone? How do you want me to get to your office if I can never drive alone? And you already said never. How can I especially never where children are known to congregate?
Well, clearly that was not an artfully worded condition of supervision. Did you ever hear of anyone being revoked or attempted to be revoked because of that condition?
Absolutely not. Same thing with the driving log of where you log every mile you drive to everything. Hey, I went to the grocery store. I went to church. No one ever asked me about it, and I never did it either. But so those are two things that you could end up going to Georgia that were not in your state. They go from New Mexico, where maybe they don't have them, wherever it is. And you end up in Georgia and they have those two things here and they say, well, where's your driving log? And you're like, I didn't have these where I came from. Sorry. Adios.
Well, now, under such a really strange scenario, there's two different things that goes. You can be retaken and not revoked. So a state that allowed you to go to Georgia, they could communicate to Georgia, we are not going to revoke them for that. But since the compact requires us to retake the person if they refuse to comply with the conditions that you've imposed, we will retake that offender. And retaking is not the same thing as revocation. So they would send you instructions to report back and be supervised there, that which might be very inconvenient depending on your life circumstances.
Would you do that one piece there? Because he did write that, and I was pleased that he wrote that about the retaking versus the revocation.
Well, the whole process is always a retaking. When a person is in a state on interstate supervision, since the state they're being supervised in cannot revoke them. They cannot revoke them. They didn't impose the supervision, so they cannot revoke it. All they can do is force the person to be retaken by the state that sent them. But when the state retakes them, they still have a choice about revoking them. So retaking is the process by which Georgia says, this person's not complying with us. We're instituting retaking, and you have to retake them. And if the sending state wishes to revoke and try to revoke, they're supposed to instruct Georgia to conduct a probable cause hearing, because that's step one in the retaking process. If Georgia establishes there's probable cause, then you go back to Colorado or whatever state, New Mexico, that you named, and you go back and have a full-blown revocation process. But when you get back, New Mexico is not going to have to revoke you. They can say, well, we're retaking him, but we don't have those conditions here, and we're not going to revoke him for those. But if you don't want to supervise him because you have those conditions, then we'll supervise him here. But again, that may be very inconvenient for you. If you get forced out of a state where you have support and job and stuff, even though you're not getting put in prison, it's not very convenient.
Do you know of a movie with Tom Hanks called Terminal?
I've not seen it, but I've heard of it.
Okay, so he is, he's from some super duper 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 small country. And while he's on an international flight, his country dissolves. So now his like passport, visa, and all that stuff are null and void. And he can't get into where he wants to go to. And there's no home to go to. So he's just stuck in the, in the whatchamacallit, what do you call it where you go? Oh, not immigration. What's the thing called at the airport?
You talking about customs?
Customs, yes. So he's stuck in the customs side of the terminal.
Well, they'll eventually.
There are worse places.
They'll eventually let him out.
I assume that they will. Anything on the ICOTS thing before we go on?
Well, I appreciate the great question.
God, this thing, we could almost have a weekly podcast about ICOTS, Larry. It's so ridiculously complicated. Makes my head spin every time we talk about it. I picked this came in an email a little while ago. It says, I have listened to your podcast on military sexual assault that we played, we did on October 24th. Our son is currently serving an 8-year sentence due to a female not wanting to admit she cheated on her fiance, who was deployed at the time the incident occurred and claimed sexual assault. She and my son had been dating for a month. This was in October of 2018. There are so many issues that happened throughout this process. Criminal Investigation Division, his UCMJ lawyer, which is the Uniform Code of Military Justice lawyers, and on and on. He was convicted on 2 counts and got 8 years at the JRCF at Fort Leavenworth. We have tried to appeal his case 2 times and we were denied with no reason. I'd love to talk to you about this.
Well, I do plan on reaching out, and I keep in mind I have such limited knowledge that I may not be the best resource, but I can at least tell you what comes to mind after I hear. So I'm planning on reaching out at some point very soon. But that scenario, it very well could happen.
Anything else? We'll just move along.
I don't have anything else to add other than we feel bad about it. That's why we had our guest. This stuff is totally out of control, apparently.
Yeah, it seems like it. Seems like you have just slightly more than zero way to defend yourself. Like you have, if you could show up with nothing, and you might do better than if you tried to defend yourself, because they'd be angry at you for wasting time or something.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Well, then moving along, we picked up a comment on our Patreon feed from Eugene, and it's about church attendance. It says, I have been on probation for 7.5 years without an infraction. Then 6 years ago, I had minister of a church fill out a form for my probation officer to allow church attendance. Recently, I wanted to attend a different church, but the rules have changed. Now the minister must drive 82 miles round trip to meet in person with my PO. I can't ask a minister to do that. Also, I suspect that he must agree to having an escort follow me to the men's room or wherever I go in the church, or in the room where the dinner is served weekly. An attractive lady invited me to dinner at the church, and I'm very lonely with no way to meet ladies. Now, this isn't the Larry's Giving Advice on Dating podcast. I assure you of that.
Well, what I would suggest is going to be difficult, but it's the only suggestion I can come up with. And he needs to take a clear look at himself and take an objective look at himself. Can they justify this as an individualized, tailored condition specifically for him related to his offense and his characteristics? We get the part that he's had all these years without an infraction. But what we don't have is what the underlying offense was. If he offended in a church, right, I think that would diminish his claim that these are unreasonable conditions. So I would first ask myself, is this specifically tailored in any way to my profile as an offender? If it is not, if it's just what they tell everybody, that the person has to, if they want to go to church, if they have to meet the PO, and that the minister has to drive to the probation office to meet, I think that not being an attorney authorized to practice law, I think that might be erecting too much of a barrier on the free exercise of religion. I think this might be a cause of action that would gain traction. But the first part is the self-eval. Find out if they can justify it for you, and find out if they're doing this for others or if it's just you.
I gotcha. Okay. And the one part that I guess that I'm not super clear on, he wanted to attend a different church, and now the minister must drive 82 miles. Like, I'm sure you can find a church that's closer than 82 miles.
Well, the minister is driving 41 miles, but what I'm taking from that is he's out in a rural area, and that he's changing churches. And this was off the radar until he decided to change churches. You know, nobody was thinking about it, but he goes in because he feels like he needs to have permission to attend the new church. And then they say, oh, and by the way, we have to meet with the minister. The question is, do they have to meet with everyone's minister, or is it because of his characteristics as his offense goes? If they have to meet with everyone's minister, and everyone's minister is asked to drive 40, 50 miles, that, is, I think, in my opinion, is erecting a very high barrier towards your freedom to worship.
I gotcha. Okay, then let's move along to the interstate combat probable cause hearing. Someone wrote in and says, I'd like to follow up on the last episode regarding ICOTS and probable cause hearings. I remember episode 164. Good grief, how do you remember episode 164? I don't remember whatever we did last week. When we discussed a case from Colorado. I've heard you people talk about it in previous episodes, but what you say does not comport with what they actually do. The lady's son was in New Mexico serving his Colorado parole and violated. The violations were relatively minor, yet he was arrested and sent back to Colorado. You use the term probable cause hearing and claim that a person on compact is entitled to a PC hearing, probable cause. Her son did not get such a hearing. He sat in the Metropolitan Detention Center for weeks, and eventually he was asked if he wanted to waive extradition to Colorado. He did. If such a right exists, why is it that nobody I've ever heard of gets one of those hearings? Boy, I already know what you're going to say.
So you're implying that this hearing is a figment of my imagination, right?
No, what you're going to say is that after you sat in jail for some period of time, you're like, screw this, I'll sign the thing, and back to where I came from I go, instead of waiting for where you have access to people that may testify for you and all the stuff. But instead of sitting there waiting it out, you go back.
Well, that's part of what I'm going to say, but it's not a figment of my imagination, even though very few people get these hearings. It's Interstate Compact Rule 5.108. And the origin of that rule is in two Supreme Court cases that occurred in 1972 and 1973. So we're talking about a long, long time that this has been a requirement. So for the Legal Beagles, the cases are Gagnon versus Scarpelli and Morrissey versus Brewer. And the rule that I just articulated, 5.108, provides that an offender subject to retaking that may result in revocation shall be afforded the opportunity to a probable cause hearing before a neutral and detached hearing officer in or reasonably near the place where the alleged violation occurred. And more importantly, no waiver of a probable cause hearing shall be accepted unless accompanied by an admission by the offender to one or more violations of the conditions of supervision. These things are not a figment of my imagination. So they're reality.
And you just booed a whole mess of legal mumbo jumbo. If a person does have such a right, why don't they schedule the hearings?
Well, that's a good question. Well, because most state legislatures have not mandated a procedure for the hearings in their statutory schemes. This means it's up to the correctional authorities to invent a process. And since it's the correctional authorities who want the offender sent back to the state of conviction, what interest would they have in creating a robust process to establish probable cause? Wouldn't that undermine their efforts to get rid of the person?
Yeah, I totally see that they don't want you here, and certainly where you came from, they don't want you there either. But so I remember that you said they mistakenly or intentionally offer extradition hearings rather than probable cause hearings. Yeah, we have talked about that, that even like the legal system doesn't understand what these hearings are supposed to be. So what's the significance of that?
Well, the significance is sometimes, depending on the jurisdiction, if a person gets arrested, they have a system in place that automatically says, if a person's in my jail, they're entitled to see a judge within so many hours. So they automatically, if they're in a local jail in the jurisdictions that have these processes in place, even though nothing has been filed in the way of a probable cause hearing, they get brought into court on a miscellaneous charge, and the judge says, why is this person in my jail? Why is this person being held? Well, Your Honor, he's on probation from Colorado, and he's being held here in Alabama because of a probation violation. Well, the judge is not real familiar with the ICOS either. He says, well, what about this? It seems like to me you ought to get on back to Colorado and get this all straightened out. Do you want to waive the extradition? And the person says, well, I don't like your jail too much down here in Alabama. And they do tend to take better care of us in Colorado. And they go ahead and sign the waiver of extradition. So then they've got a signed document that the offender signed without the benefit of any legal advice, oftentimes because due to the lack of public defender resources, often they've not had any consultation with anybody. And even if they did, the person didn't know jack about what they were talking about because they were what we call guppy attorneys. They got hired to do first appearances, and they have never heard of the interstate compact. So that's often what goes on here. But the difference is significant. It's really different because the scope of the inquiry afforded to a person in an extradition hearing is quite different as opposed to a probable cause hearing. The scope in an extradition hearing is limited to the identity of the person and the validity of the fugitive demand. Now remember, fugitive. This person is not a fugitive. They're in Alabama on permission from Colorado to be supervised, so they're no fugitive. So we don't need to identify them. They've already been identified. But in an extradition hearing, a person gets picked up and NCIC reveals a warrant for them in another state. So the only inquiry that takes place in an extradition hearing is, are you the person who's named in this arrest warrant? And has the state that wants you back that's making the fugitive demand, have they put the proper paperwork together to make that demand, which includes some documents from the governor's office? That's the significant difference. That's not a probable cause determination. That's an identity determination.
So what would that extradition hearing differ from? How would it differ from a probable cause hearing?
Well, in the probable cause hearing, the offender would be entitled to the following rights. They'd get a written notice of the violations because we can't do ambush litigation. So the probation people are going to have to show you a list of things that you violated. They're going to get disclosure of non-privileged, non-confidential evidence regarding the alleged violations. They're going to get the opportunity to be heard and to present witnesses and documentary evidence relevant to the violations, and the opportunity to confront and cross-examine the adverse witnesses, unless the hearing officer determines that there's some risk of harm to the witness. But you're going to have a robust proceeding taking place. The probation department is going to tell you in writing what you did wrong. They're going to tell you who they're going to call against you, which may be the probation officer usually, but possibly law enforcement, maybe some civilian witnesses. You're going to get the opportunity to confront those witnesses and ask them questions. And a real probable cause, you're not going to get to do that in an extradition hearing. The judge is going to say, are you John Paul Jones, born 6/1958? Yeah. And you're going to say, no, Your Honor, I am not. And the judge is going to say, well, then we're going to force the demanding state to prove that you're John Paul Jones. It's going to take some time. I'm going to give them 30 days. They're going to submit fingerprints, DNA, whatever they have, that they're going to prove, they're going to tie you to being the fugitive named in this warrant. You can cool out in our jail, and you can wait. That's all the evidence that's going to be taken in the extradition demand. It's quite different from a probable cause hearing.
And this almost sounds like what we're talking about, Larry, is that the Miranda rights, you have the right to remain silent, you have a right to an attorney. Like, we kind of sort of all know those by rote memory of watching every legal procedure show that exists. This almost needs to be formalized into an expression like that to tell you you have the right to a probable cause hearing, you have the right to bring forth evidence and witnesses, etc.
I agree with you. I wish it happened, but the probation authorities, they're not wanting that to happen because
sure,
they want you off of their caseload. I know this sounds so crass and so rude, but if you're a supervising probation officer and you've got someone you have bad vibes about, You would much rather them be offending in the state that convicted them than in your state.
Of course, of course, of course.
So therefore, they're going to look for ways to get rid of as many as they can if they have any hesitation about them, because they much prefer the camera go rolling in the state to the probation office that's supervising them, that convicted them, rather than saying, how did that happen here?
And this person waived extradition and voluntarily agreed to return to Colorado. Did he disadvantage himself by doing that?
Yes, he did. Potentially he did anyway. Even if they did not revoke him in Colorado, he's now, at least after he got sent back there, he was stuck there and he had to apply again to be transferred. And had he had a proper hearing in New Mexico, he might never have been transported to Colorado. So we don't know what would have happened, but we know that he didn't advantage himself in any way. At best, he disadvantaged himself because he has to start the process all over again to come back to New Mexico, and they're going to do everything they can to slow that train down.
It does sound to me like it would be significantly better to have the probable cause hearing. So how does John Q. Public on their, when they end up getting locked up for some sort of revocation kind of thing, how do they get this probable cause hearing? How do they get such a hearing?
I wish I could answer that. I have not been able to rectify this problem systemically. I've had some success on a case-by-case basis by, I invented a filing, a pleading called a petition, a notice of demand for a probable cause hearing in the receiving state. So that's what your attorney would style the action. The problem you have is that most of the attorneys are not up to speed on the ICAOS, and they're hesitant to file such a motion because they've never seen it before. And trying to file it, because remember, you don't have an action going in the state where you're being supervised, so there's no case number to attach it to. So you have to go into the old-fashioned courthouse, the old-fashioned way, and you have to get a clerk to agree to let you file something under miscellaneous case number, because normally it would be filed under your sentencing case number, right? If there's something to be filed.
I'll take your word for it, but I got you.
Yeah, it would be filed under your sentencing case. Well, you don't have a sentencing case, because you're in the state you're being supervised, you're a guest there being supervised as a courtesy. So you don't have anything. So the attorneys try and pull their hair out, trying to figure out. And I tell them, well, you file a miscellaneous case. Well, how do you do that? Well, in this day of electronic filing, you have drop-down menus. When you go on, you've got people like Andy who've set up these platforms, and they've got things all neat and clean for you to select a drop down, but they don't have a miscellaneous filing of a notice of a demand for a probable cause hearing. So you can't open a case in the state of supervision. So due to all the barriers and the confusion, it just never happens. And the people end up agreeing to go back to the state. It's a tragedy, but it happens.
Wow. God, is this a mess. What I'm thinking is that everyone that is on PFR type probation should have your number tattooed on the inside of their eyelids. That way, when they do get arrested for whatever, they can look up your number and call you and have you help them find the attorney that will represent them best, and you can advise them on how to go about. It just sounds like that would be the smart move.
I could indeed, if these people had enough money to buy my time.
Oh, I see. I thought you were free.
So, well, I am on the podcast.
I heard cheap and sleazy on a bathroom wall.
So,
no, but that's not you.
There's one other thing that you can do that conceivably could throw a monkey wrench in it, is you could file in your state where you were sentenced. You could file notice of a demand for a probable cause hearing in the receiving state. Now, of course, that court cannot force the receiving state. Remember, if you file something in Colorado court where you're sentenced, and you say, I'm demanding a probable cause hearing in Alabama, they don't have any jurisdiction to force Alabama to do anything. But what you could do is put the court in Colorado on notice that their revocation is going to be tainted by the fact that you haven't had this probable cause determination, which may limit their options when they finally get you back, because you weren't brought back through the legitimate process. That's another thing you could do. Again, you're going to have pushback from the attorneys, because they're going to say, well, you know, once we get you up here, we'll just straighten this all out with the judge. I'll talk to the DA and I'll get this all worked out. And you say, but I want you to file this just in case the DA is not reasonable. Then I want the judge to know that the process by which I was returned to Colorado has been tainted because I wasn't given a PC hearing in Alabama.
Oh my God. What a nightmare. Like, for real, it probably, God, unless you're in Alabama or some state like that, it is probably better to just stay where you are until you're done with your supervision and can then move without having to bother with this. This is such a convoluted, complicated mess. For real.
It is indeed. It absolutely is. And a lot of people don't have that option. You know, they get out of their sentence. They have nowhere to go, and they have connections in these states that are not very desirable to go to. But the other option is to either be held in prison, like in Illinois, where they hold you in prison. Do you have a place to go? Or they do the same thing in my state. They hold you in prison. Do you have a place to go? Or your option is to go to some place where you have some level of support and hope you can work your way through it. And that's what they choose to do.
Sure. Oh my God. So I thought we had a talk pre-show about you were going to be happy and positive and inspirational, but no, you deliver this garbage.
Well, I thought I was delivering it with happiness and inspiration.
Okay. Yeah. Somebody already said scary Larry. All right. Then we will move over. We have some feature articles that you have provided for us this evening. Shall we move over there, sir?
Sure. Let's do this one. This first one's going to be fun because we already talked about it on the last one, except it was a different state.
Okay. Oh, okay. So this is from the Texas Tribune. And prison contractor MTC accused of billing Texas millions for inmate treatment programs it didn't provide. Now, that's fun. One of the country's largest private prison companies has defrauded Texas by collecting millions of dollars for improperly billing the state for thousands of unmanned prisoners for in-prison therapeutic programming it hasn't provided during the pandemic. A new complaint filed with the state auditor claims. Now, that is funny, Larry.
Well, I'm funny. You think that's funny. That's odd, but I'll go along with you. It is funny.
So back in 2020, as the coronavirus killed thousands of prisoners across the country, a push to release more people eligible for parole was met with firm resistance by the Texas Board of Pardon and Paroles. And the board continued requiring most prisoners approved for parole to first complete treatment programming, which means they're getting together with a bunch of other people who are probably infected with the virus, which generally takes 3 to 9 months and focuses on life skills, substance abuse, rehabilitation, or treatment for those convicted of PFR type things. What did the company do that was so illegal then, Larry?
Well, the Texas prisons largely kept men and women confined to their cells or dorms, and people inside told the Texas Tribune that much of the required programming wasn't occurring. On Monday, prison rights advocacy group Latino Justice alleged that despite the lack of services, Management and Training Corporation continued charging the state for programs and forced prisoners to falsify documents stating they had received treatment. Now, you have to admit that's funny if it's true.
That is definitely funny. And this isn't the first time that MTC, a private prison operator, I know you're going to stand up on that high horse again about the private sector, whatever, the free market economy will fix everything, right? A private prison operator, which also contracts with state prisons for rehabilitation programming, has faced other fraud allegations. Just last week, Mississippi's state auditor demanded MTC pay nearly $2 million on guard shifts after an investigation by the Marshall Project.
Well, what my high horse is that I always hear people that lean conservative talk about fraud. And fraud is a bad thing. But it seems like their voices become very weak when it comes to corporate fraud and large-scale fraud. They worry about, in these conservative states, they worry about food stamps. They worry about the person taking a drug test. They impose all these regimens to make sure that that their $200 worth of SNAP benefits that they have to be clean and sober and all this stuff. And they allege fraud. Well, I don't condone fraud, but I would like to hear the same amount of anger when it comes to this type of fraud. And I'm hoping that the governor of Texas, who just got resoundingly reelected, and the governor of Mississippi, I hope these governors will be on their high horse about fraud and find it just as obnoxious as the fraud that they tend to be so critical of, because fraud is fraud, and they shouldn't be doing it. If it's true, and I remember these are allegations, the presumption is right now that MTC has not done anything wrong, so they can choose to force both states to prove these allegations, or they can agree to settle. But right now, the presumption is they haven't done anything wrong.
I gotcha. Anything else here before we move over to the Reason article?
No, that's enough on this.
Okay. Like I said, Reason. Now, I do think that this will be funny, Larry. No, it's not funny. Alabama jails woman for endangering her fetus. Wait, seriously? Her fetus. She wasn't pregnant. The lawsuit alleges false imprisonment after arrest for endangering a fetus that didn't exist. Another Alabama woman has been jailed for using drugs while pregnant. But this time there's a twist. She wasn't actually pregnant. Her young child merely told a social worker that she was, according to the woman's lawsuit against local law enforcement in Etowah. We've covered them before, Larry. Etowah County.
Yeah, this is quite entertaining, unless you're the one who got locked up.
Totally.
But again, folks, we're supposed to validate charges before we file them against people. I'm not sure a child's recollection that mommy's pregnant would be sufficient before I would seek a warrant to arrest someone for endangering a fetus. I would like to have some documentation that there actually is a fetus. I mean, that's not too much to ask.
This is totally just on the heels of the Dobbs decision then too.
Well, I'm not seeing the connection, but what are you saying?
The connection would be that if abortion is not a legal thing in Alabama, then would be one of the states that would say no under any circumstances at all. And so here you are, let's just say that she did these things and harmed the fetus. Then you are committing a crime against a human being. That's what this, that's where this comes from.
That is correct. And that's why they locked her up.
Right. So this is totally on the heels of the Dobbs decision. This is an impact of it, an effect of it.
But they didn't have the requisite evidence. I'm not even getting into the debate about whether that's right or not. But
I'm with you.
When you level a criminal complaint, prosecutors, I know there are dozens of you out there listening, you have a higher ethical duty under the rules of professional conduct. You need to know that a crime has occurred within your jurisdiction, and you need to have significant evidence that points towards the person whose liberty you're about to put in jeopardy and their reputation in jeopardy that they committed a crime. If you don't know the person's pregnant, you don't have proof of that, you're a step ahead of yourself. You can hold off on filing charges until you actually have the requisite evidence. You don't file the charges and try to build a case later, which too often prosecutors do.
Right. That's a really bizarre article there. She wasn't even pregnant. And I'm laughing, and I'm sorry if you were the one in prison. I am not laughing at you. That is just really high on the redonkulous scale. Have you heard of that word before, Larry? Redonkulous?
I can't understand how our transcriber is going to spell that. We'll find out.
All right, from the AP News. Oh, God, we're going to get bashed for being all lefty and whatnot. Wave of sex abuse lawsuits seen as New York opens door for victims. Sexual assault victims in New York will get a one-time opportunity to sue over their abuse starting Thursday under a new law expected to bring a wave of allegations against prison guards, middle managers, doctors, and a few prominent figures, including former President Donald Trump. For 1 year, the state will waive all normal deadlines for filing lawsuits over sex crimes, enabling survivors to seek compensation for assaults that happened years or even decades ago. Now, come on, you've got to side with the victims and say, what could you possibly find wrong with this, Larry?
Well, I don't have a side in this other than I work on the defense side. And on the defense side, old allegations are virtually impossible for a person who's been accused to receive a fair trial. And in a civil setting, which is what we're talking about here, the threshold of proof, the burden of proof is far lower. So you're talking about just a preponderance of the evidence. So if someone brings decades-old allegations against you in a civil setting, A, you don't have the right to counsel to be appointed for you if you've somehow lost your, you know, if you don't have money, because you're not in risk of losing your liberty. But they may sue you anyway as a part of going after the deeper pockets of whoever you worked for. You know, whatever entity you were involved with, be it the scouts, be it the university or whatever, you know, your employer. And therefore you're not going to get a fair shake. You're going to be more concerned about, of course, if you have assets to lose because you worked all your life and you accumulated a little bit of wealth and you're 58 years old and somebody says you did something when they're 28 and they clean you out and you have a very a low level of proof required in a civil case. So what's wrong with it is the person can't get a fair trial. That's the only thing that's wrong with it.
A person in chat says, I'm currently being sued by my victim because of a temporary look-back period on statute of limitations, revocation and sex crimes in D.C. Ow! So then it goes on. I feel like I've been in jail for almost 3 decades, said the person they reported with, who's 49, who said she was abused by the millionaire and notorious sex offender Jeffrey Epstein when she was a young woman. And it's more than time for me with other victims to be free of that prison that we've been in and for the people who are accountable to be held accountable. And what would you say to the individual being reported with?
I'd say that I'm sorry that this happened and it's too bad the allegations weren't brought in a timely manner. I'd also say that justice indeed has an expiration date because people are entitled to fairness and people can't receive a fair adjudication and trial decades later. So I'm terribly sorry this happened. It's unfortunate, but in my mind, it's too late.
All right. And then finally, we have an article from Source New Mexico, I guess, Source NM.
Yes. What on earth did you drag this crap in here for?
You're no kidding. New Mexico public defenders beg lawmakers for funding as workloads grow heavier. Budget panel warned that without boost in resources, state could be violating constitutional rights to effective legal counsel. So the New Mexico public defenders say they have too many clients and nowhere near enough attorneys to represent them. And without more funding, they say people accused of crimes are losing out on their constitutional rights to adequate defense and due process. I don't know why you care about due process, Larry. When someone is charged with a crime in New Mexico, there is a good chance that they can't afford their own attorney and must be provided one by the state. And among those attorneys, many are not actually employed by the state law offices of the public defender, but are contractors instead. Why do you people have contract attorneys when you have so many statewide public defender systems? You have such a big one.
Well, a number of reasons. Some of our counties are too small to justify having a public defender office. We've got a county that has 1,000 people in it. And wow. Another reason is that the public defender can easily have a conflict with a case. For example, there may be multiple defendants and it would create an ethical conflict for the public defender to represent multiple defendants that were involved in the same case. So therefore, they'll send out the additional defendants to contract attorneys. So there's a number of reasons why that happens.
I would also imagine that with depending on the kind of case, a public defender could be just out of their league. It could be a very significant. Well, I'm just thinking O.J. Simpson size case and you're the public defender. You're like, I don't know what to do with this. I assume that would also be a scenario.
I would like to think that's not as likely of a scenario here because of the highly specialized nature. And we've got a great system here. It's not great enough, obviously, but we do have, they have some highly specialized units where they send complicated cases to. So, you know, if it's a complicated case, you're not going to end up with a first-year law student or, you know, a first-year, not law student, but a first-year right. attorney. Yeah. So I'd like to think that's not really the reason, but people look at it that way. They think their case is just so complicated that only a private attorney can understand it. But
I mean, the difference would be very procedural, I suppose, but whatever. Anyway, I mean, they went to the same schools is really the thought that I was thinking through. It's not like one went to a public defender school and the other one went to private sector school. But when a contractor does take it on, for example, a first degree murder case, they are paid a base rate of $5,400 for the entire case. That means on average, the attorney is making $13.81 per hour representing their client, according to a study of the New Mexico Public Defender's workload published in January. Those numbers should shock us, says Representative Ryan Lane of Aztec told the Legislative Finance Committee on Tuesday afternoon. Are you shocked, Larry?
No, not at all, because we've had this problem for many years. But let's give credit to Representative Lane for his recognition of the problem, because he's a Republican. He represents the very conservative part of the state. And typically there's not a high level support for public defender increasing those resources. So let's see if we actually increase the pay for the contract attorneys. But I appreciate Representative Lane's position.
The office is asking the legislature for a $13.2 million more funds from the state's general fund, about 21% more than what's being spent now on public defenders. The request includes $4.2 million to increase contract attorney compensation, $1.2 million for in-house attorney compensation, and $5.7 million to add 60 full-time staff, including 30 attorneys. The request for funding more staff is based on recommendations from a four-year-long workload study released in January that found three times more defense attorney hours are needed across New Mexico to provide adequate legal representation. I have to ask you, Larry, this is an important question. Do you think they will get the money? Now that you're done cracking up.
No, they will not get anywhere near that amount of money, in my opinion. They will get an increase. We're actually financially, we're doing okay because of the elevated energy prices, and effectively about a third of our state revenue comes from energy production, be it natural gas and oil from the Permian Basin. But you also have every agency looking for more resources, every single agency that of the state government, whether it be the Taxation and Revenue Department that collects the taxes, whether it be the Children, Youth, and Families Department that works with children, whether it be infrastructure and roads, whether it be prisons. Yeah, everybody, Department of Environment, everybody's wanting more money. And it's going to be difficult when you start looking at the requests that are more popular. When you look at what all state government does, things are far more popular than representing criminals. And therefore, when you're divvying up new funding, which we will have a lot of new dollars in the state budget this year because of the high energy prices, it's a lot more voter friendly to give those monies to other programs. The Department of Veterans Services. Now, would you rather go out campaigning on what you had done to improve the life of veterans, or would you rather go out campaigning on what you had done to improve the life of people accused of crimes? Tell me, which do you think you would garner more votes?
I'm pretty sure the veteran issue would gain you a whole lot more popularity.
So therefore, they're not likely to get this amount of money. And we've had this discussion over several years, and they'll get an increase, and it'll be probably above the rate of inflation, but I'll be shocked if it's 21%. I'll expect it to be more in the 8-10% range.
All right, sir. I don't have anything else on the schedule for this evening. Do you?
No. And you see why we pulled those articles, because we would have run out of time.
Nah, one of them was super short that we probably should have covered anyway. But we will get to it next week. I tried to ask them again if we can do anything about the podcast getting on the tablets in prison. That's what one of them was about. But I will address it more fully next weekend. Next weekend. So well, nothing else, Larry?
That was one thing that I had forgotten that was in there. And that was one I'm getting, more than just the one I put in there. I'm getting regular inquiries about that. And maybe we need to task someone that's got more time on their hands, maybe even the transcriptionist, to get on the old-fashioned phone and start calling people, because they've not been very receptive to email communication.
Right. I mean, I followed their procedure and went to, like, I had emailed someone, they emailed back and they said, go to this website and fill out their form. I know that I filled it out before, and I filled it out again tonight, and it says, we've received it and we will get back to you shortly. And I mean, like, I'm saying we're a 501c3. We are trying to provide factual, non-biased, non-partisan information about how to help people be productive, get out, follow the rules, navigate this whole thing. That's what we're trying to do. And like, I mean, it's just basically, I could have just thrown it all in the trash can and put it out the window.
Oh, well, I'm over my head in terms of, I can't really be of any help, but I would like to, if people have tablets and can listen to us, I would very much be supportive of that. I mean, it's not about the money.
Oh, God,
it's really
awesome.
about the information. I mean, they will come to us when they get out and be appreciative of what we provided to them.
And it's obviously a captive marketplace, and these are the people that need the information probably the mostest, right? Transcriptionist mostest?
I would say so, because there's such a lack of information that's reliable. They get all sorts of just rumors and misinformation, and we're trying to clean it up as best we can. Sometimes we do, like tonight, and we tell you there's not a really a clear answer to the question.
Sure. Well, very good, sir. Find all the show notes and everything that you need over at registrymatters.co. You can find phone numbers and links to everything over there at the Registry Matters main page. And we didn't get any new Patreon people. I can double check real quick, but I don't think there was. Did we get any new snail mail people?
I think that I've got 5 coming our way as soon as the person provides the names to me.
Oh, that's true. And then I also sent you another one from the guest we had on a few weeks ago, right?
Yes, yes. I think I activated that one, but we'll make sure. But I think I activated that one already.
Very good. Well, that is all that I have for everything. And I thank everybody. We had a pretty good crowd in listening live. So those are the patrons. And I appreciate y'all so very much. Thanks for hanging out. There was good chat tonight. It wasn't like a bunch of crickets. And I know that you are following on with bated breath watching those people chat in there, Larry.
Yes, indeed, I am.
Have a great night, everybody, and we will talk to you soon. Take care, Larry. Bye.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.